From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very, very good afternoon to you. It's Travels with Kate. It's 101.9. It's High FM. Couple of things, housekeeping, before we go into our program today. Had lots and lots of comments about Samara and the Eastern Cape. And so many of you are saying, but where can we see photographs? Go to my website, kateturkington.com. That's all. www, you don't even need that, kateturkington.com. You'll see posts from all over the world, but you'll also see a post I've just put up now with lovely photographs of the Eastern Cape and of Samara, kateturkington.com. And now have a pen or a pencil ready, because also I've been asked, we talked about Marine Protected Areas Day. Do you remember we interviewed Dr. Judy Mann from the Two Oceans Aquarium about Marine Protected Areas Day? And do you remember she told us that in South Africa we have 41 marine protected areas. And how do we think of them? We think of them as the game reserves of the ocean. Some are near to shore, some are further out in the ocean. And there are even marine rangers who look after these places for us. So several of you have said, where can we go? Where are these marine protected areas? Where would be a good place to visit? So I thought I'd give you some suggested places you could go to. So as I say, have a pen or pencil handy, and all you do when I give you the name is then you can Google it for yourself. So Marine Protected Areas Day, I mean, the potential for ecotourism is enormous. We all go off to game reserves. We go here, we go there. We haven't been going to these marine protected areas. So I'm going to suggest some places for you to go to. Examples of ecotourism really round the marine protected areas. Well, now a great place is the Western Cape near to Hoop. There's the I want to pronounce this correctly. Makurukuru family de Hoop. doesn't trip off my tongue easily. Morukuru. I'm going to spell it for you. Morukuru. Morukuru family de Hoop. There's a beach lodge. There's a beautiful, exclusive Morukuru ocean house. So you've got the unspoilt coastline, you've got the scenic beauty of the reserve, you've got the famous vegetation, and of course you've got the abundant marine life. And Dahoop Marine Protected Area is some of the best land-based whale watching anywhere in the world, let alone in Africa. Why? Because the whales aren't disturbed by boats. You can actually stand on the shore and watch whales, particularly at this time of year at Dahoop. The southern right whales are calving there, and I've seen up to 100 in the bay there. So Morukuru family Dahoop, and wonderful sensation. You feel just alone there with the whales and the wildlife. And there are guided marine walks at low tide. You can do a fynbos or a nature walk. And if you want to be a bit more active, you can do mountain biking, you can do dune boarding, you can do snorkeling, you can swim in the tidal pools. And also, you're pretty sure to get a glimpse of the resident turtles, because I've been telling you the story of Bob, who's really Bobby, whom the two oceans, do you say whom of a turtle or whom is actually, anyway, we'll say whom, Bobby, who's now transversing the oceans all around the Western Cape. And the place, the Morokuru family to her, employs 42 people and nearly 2,000 guests every year. So really a wonderful, wonderful place to go. And I'll give you some more places after the break. So if you don't have pen and pencil now, just quickly grab a pen and pencil while we're taking a pen or pencil while we're taking a break.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. It's Travels with Kate. I'm Kate Turkington. I'm suggesting to you some of the places you can go to, because many of you ask me, where can you go to visit these marine protected areas and where would good places be to stay? So another very, very good Cape-based, Western Cape-based tourism establishment, and they've also leveraged the De Hoop Nature Reserve, is African Sunroad. African Sunroad. You can just Google them. You'll get the website, etc. So they have nature guides. They have hikes. They also have wine walks. And they have a special focus on the 55-kilometer whale trail, which goes all the way through the nature reserve from Potberg to Kopi Alien. And apparently they only get about 80 tourists a year for the whale trail. You have to book that well in advance. And more tourists want to go. So just Google African Sun Road. And then another tourism establishment, very, very near to Hoop, MPA, Marine Protected Area, is Marine Dynamics. And they have island cruises, and they also have a Marine Dynamics Academy, which trains young people and the community. And African Penguins, Seabird Sanctuary, Dye Island Conservation Trust. So they have actually been campaigning. This is interesting. They've been campaigning to have that great Dye Island, that's D-Y-E-R, Dye Island area, demarcated as an MPA, as Marine Protected area. So they're doing their best. Again, 130 people work there. They get up to 40,000 visitors a year. Obviously, look, if you can go out of school holidays or varsity holidays at times that are quieter, it's much, much easier, and you'll also get very, very good, offers. And you can see the Marine Big Five. Did you know what the Marine Big Five were? I'm a bit again Big Fives, but let me tell you. The Marine Big Five are sharks, whales, African penguins, seals, and dolphins. Okay. Now, where would you eat? There's a very, very nice restaurant called Pearly's Restaurant in Lungebarn. It's right near the West Coast National Park, and obviously that benefits from the people coming to see the MPA. And of course now I see one of the, can't remember if it was the Karoo National Park, one of the national parks, before I came in today, I saw a photo, the flowers are blooming. The flowers have started in the Western Cape. So now, not only go for your marine protected areas, but go for your flowers too. Now, you all know about Robben Island, where internationally renowned, because it's where President Nelson Mandela spent so long. Did you know that Robben Island is also an MPA? It's a marine protected area, home to the third largest African penguin colony. So that's a big tourism draw card, not just to go and see our history, but also if you're interested in wildlife, the African penguins there. So, and endangered, of course, our African penguin. Okay, so that's another of the places you can go to. Now let's move away from the Western Cape and go to KZN, which has three MPAs, three marine protected areas, one of which is a world-class dive site, Protea Banks. I'm sure if you're a diver, you'll have heard of it, Protea Banks. And the company to work with there is African Dive Adventures. African Dive Adventures. Jot it down. That gives up to 1,000 divers a year the chance to experience that incredible marine life there. You know, and only now is the term MPA getting widely known. And I had some feedback from our own MPA day from the Two Oceans Aquarium. It went international. We started it in South Africa, Marine Protected Areas Day. They had a tremendous international cooperation this year. So, and of course, if we're in KZN, there's a very, very nice accommodation called Kingfisher Lakeside Retreat. I mean, it's actually known for its fossil remains found on the beach. But what happens there once a year? The greatest shoal on earth, the annual sardine run. I must say I've never done that. Millions of sardines migrate along that coast. People go with their buckets, they go with their pots, they top them up with sardines, the greatest shoal on earth. If you're interested, get hold of Kingfisher Lakeside Retreat and they'll give you all the info. And of course, one you will have heard of is the Isimangaliso Wetland Park. Lots to do there. Used to be St. Lucia, the Isimangaliso Wetland Park. Very, very nice establishment there. It's called Adventure Mania. Adventure Mania. Scuba diving, snorkeling, boat rides, and also going out to the MPA and looking at the wildlife there. So these are just some of the, they're recommended by the Two Oceans Aquarium, have been personally visited, have proper ethical standards and integrity, because it's also a lot of, I'm trying to think of a euphemism for fly-by-night operators, and I can't. But these ones I've suggested to you are ethical, and you'll get wonderful value for money there. So just some of the MPAs that you can visit in South Africa.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Welcome back. You're traveling with Kate, and of course it's Sunday. And I just want to alert you to one particular book before we talk to the most amazing woman who almost single-handedly has changed the way we look after wildlife in Africa. I mean, she really is on a par with Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey, but more of that anon. There's a new book out called Sappy Tree Spotting. Now, don't be put off by this. You've all got trees in your garden. Maybe you know what some of them are. Maybe you don't. This is a really user-friendly book, Sappy Tree Spotting. It's by Val Thomas and Rena Grant. And it's tree spotting in the bushveld, also Pelansberg and Mahalisberg. And I've actually, in my little garden in Johannesburg, I've been getting some very strange pods like four-winged pods, and I had no idea where they came from. Looked them up in the book, because there's lots of lovely illustrations, lots of photographs. It's such an easy-to-use book, and I see they come from bush willows. I have no notion where those bush willows are growing, but they're growing somewhere near my garden, and they're blowing their windborne into my garden. So just if you want to know about trees in general, the great thing about trees, you know, I mean, I'm a birder, you know that. Birds fly away, trees don't. So you can actually have a very, very good look at a tree. I was in a nursery at the corner of Jan Smuts and Chester in Parktown at the weekend, and I sat there in my car actually looking at a huge, huge trunk of a plane tree in the parking lot of the nursery. And I reckon, I actually had the book with me, had a quick look. It was a plane tree. I reckon it must be 100 years old. Just think what that tree has seen in its lifetime. It saw Johannesburg when it was a mining camp. It saw history, and there it stands today in our lifetime. It's a lovely book. If you're going on holiday, if you're going to the bush, if you're going to Peelandsburg, if you're going to the Mahalisburg, Sappy Tree Spotting. You know Sappy does an excellent bird guide. Sappy Tree Spotting by Val Thomas and Rena Grant. It's very different. Teaches you to understand the area you're in. It teaches you to find trees very easily by ecozone or habitat. Takes you through a very easy six-step guide. Grandchildren would love this book. They would love to spot the trees in your garden or in your neighborhood. Shows you pictures of the flowers, the bean pods, the plums, the berries, the leaves, the bark. And here's something I didn't know. You know, I love cricket, so I do have a thing about the Aussies. We have in South Africa a lot of acacia trees. And the very first time acacia was used, the word acacia was used, was actually in 1772 by the father of modern-day taxonomy, Carl Linnaeus. He's the one who described species. And he described Acacia nilotica. Nilotica, achy or achis, acacia, means a sharp points because of the thorns on the tree, and nilotica, the Nile, because the specimen he named came from Egypt. Okay, so bear with me. At one time, there were over 1,000 species of acacia globally, but the most of them were in Australia, and they didn't have thorns. And recently it was discovered that all these species don't, in fact, belong to the same genus, so they needed to change the names. So do you know what the Aussies did? In 2005, the Australians approached the International Botanical Congress. I didn't even know there was such a thing. But the Aussies went off to the International Botanical Congress to ask if they could retain the genus Acacia, since they had 1,000 species. So in other words, Aussies wanted to trademark the name Acacia. And can you believe it? The International Botanical Congress said, yes, Australia, you can have the name Acacia trees. We lost it. We lost it in South Africa. We're not supposed to call ours Acacia trees anymore. We're not supposed to call them Vakelia. I think it's a cheek. How can you claim a plant just for yourselves? Anyway, no more acacias. So when you see that flat-topped acacia tree, which is so, so indicative of the African bush, you know, that one stem and the flat top, you're not supposed to call it an acacia tortilla, because of the flat top anymore. It's a vakelia. There you are. Useless bit of general knowledge that you can use at your next family meeting or whatever. And very shortly, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Gladys Klemmer Sikusoka about her book, Walking with Gorillas. She was the first ever black woman wildlife vet in Uganda. She has now, through her programs working with public health, she has actually changed the way that we look at wildlife and nearby communities. I mean, there's adventure in the book, there's drama, there's passion, lots of gorillas. And she's been called Dr. Gladys Klemmer Sikusoka, one of Africa's greatest conservation eco-heroes. So she's now being named alongside Jane Goodall, of course, with the chimpanzees, who I've interviewed a couple of times in my lifetime, and Diane Fossey of the Gorillas in the Mist, who certainly I didn't interview. So Dr. Gladys Klemmer Sikusoka coming up next.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
We're going to talk now with a very, very special lady indeed. She's just published her book, Walking with Gorillas, The Journey of an African Wildlife Vet, by Dr. Gladys Klemmer Sikusoka. It's published by Arcade. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about her before we meet her. She really is one of Africa's greatest conservation eco-heroes, and she works in one of the world's most challenging environments. I've been to windy, impenetrable forests. I just know how impenetrable it is. She's Dr. Gladys is a Ugandan vet, the first of her kind, and she's forged a unique career and also put her life on the line to protect one of the world's most spectacular and spectacularly threatened species, the mountain gorilla. So, welcome, Dr. Gladys.
Thank you so much for inviting me to the show.
Now, Gladys, yours is a wonderful and inspiring story. I mean, you don't look old enough, but a 30-year journey in conservation. I want to know, how did it all start?
I think I would say that it started at home, growing up with so many pets at home and falling in love with them. My older brother used to bring stray cats and dogs home, and I adopted them. They became my companions because the sister who I followed was just outside my age bracket to play with. And then one time we had a pet velvet monkey that came home from the next door neighbors, the Cuban ambassador to Uganda. And that monkey used to pull the cats and dogs' tails, steal food from the kitchen. Very naughty velvet monkey. And one time when I was practicing the piano, I noticed that I wasn't alone. And when I moved out of the room, he imitated me and played one note.
Yo.
And I was really amused and fascinated by that. And that made me realize that not only do his fingernails look like mine and his fingers, but he can actually play the piano. And so I think that was when I really got into thinking about other kinds of animals. And then when I was in high school in Uganda, my final year of high school, I got an opportunity to set up a wildlife club. We took the children to Queen Elizabeth National Park at a time when there was very little wildlife. A lot of it had been poached during the Idi Amin era when he was the president of Uganda. And the soldiers who were getting rid of him also poached animals. And so I was a bit disappointed that we saw very little wildlife. We could even go on walking safaris because there were no predators. And the elephants had gone to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I could be a vet who also works with wildlife. Yeah. And so later on, I finally got to work with captive and wild chimpanzees in Uganda. And then the mountain gorillas at Bwindi as a vet student. And having spent time with the gorillas in Bwindi, I felt 1 month, I saw the threats they were facing. And I said, why don't I just become a full-time wildlife vet? And I became Uganda's first full-time wildlife vet.
Would you, Dr. Gladys, you make it sound very easy. First of all, you're Uganda's first-time vet, first-time black vet, and a woman. There must have been enormous challenges.
Yes, they were enormous challenges. First of all, people didn't know what a vet does in wildlife, so I had to spend a lot of time explaining to my colleagues, the conservation biologists, that it's not only about natural selection, but you also have to intervene when it's human-related or life-threatening, particularly with species as endangered as the mountain gorillas were at the time. In fact, they were critically endangered, with only about 650 left in the whole world. And, you know, so there was a lot of explaining to my colleagues where we have to handle the animals, where we have to move them. We also moved elephants and giraffes for elephants that were raiding crops and giraffes because we're down to one female giraffe, one of the national parks, and we had to bring some females over from Kenya to Uganda, to Kidepo. So it's been, there was a lot of explaining that. Actually, the fact that I was a woman, I didn't really notice it so much because I had a unique experience. So, I mean, I had a unique expertise. So people needed me when it came to animal welfare issues or moving animals. So nobody showed me to my face that you're a woman and we don't take you that seriously. I never really noticed it until much later. But there were no female rangers at that time. And right now, at least we have at least 20% of the rangers working in the national parks are female. And yeah, it was a very interesting and exciting time. I have to say that, yeah, maybe because I had a unique skill and I was very determined to make things work and I was very determined to see what we can do for the wildlife. I think that helped me to keep going and not really notice, you know, if people weren't taking me seriously because of my gender or because of my color.
Yeah. Now, you believe, and this is so important, and this is one of the reasons you've become famous and so well known. You believe in conservation through public health. Let me just explain that. You believe that it's impossible to ensure the survival of gorillas, wildlife, critical ecosystems in Africa without helping their human neighbours. Now, can you talk us through that, Dr. Gladys?
Yes, we have to help their human neighbours. I mean, I started out as Uganda's first wildlife vet and was hired to focus on the animals, but I quickly realised that people are affecting the animals in more ways than one. Because even if I was hired because gorilla tourism had just begun and the government was concerned that tourists who are visiting gorillas could bring a fatal flu, such as COVID-19, I ended up with the first disease that actually affected the gorillas was not from the tourists, but from the local communities. Once you habituate gorillas for tourism or for research, they lose their fear of people and they can easily start ranging outside the park. Because they go back to places where it used to be part of their home range before their habitat got cut. And so we found that the two gorilla groups habituated for tourism were going outside the park. And one time I got a call, they said to me that one of the groups was losing hair and developing white scaly skin, all of them. And I was really shocked. But I spoke to a human doctor friend of mine in Kampala. And she told me, I asked her, what is the most common skin disease in people? And she said, it's scabies. Which I found surprising because I did my vet training at the Royal Vet College, University of London, and you rarely got people who had, you know, a severe incidence of scabies. They'd probably pick up a mild infection from their cat or dog, but it never really stayed. And she said, yes, low-income groups of people tend to have it because they had inadequate hygiene. So we went with a drug that treats scabies called ivermectin, and we got there, and I was with a vet from Kenya who was setting up the Kenya Wildlife Service Vet Unit, and he had seen scabies in cheetahs in Masai Mara that were visited by many vehicles, and those that were not didn't have scabies. So he thought if it is scabies, it could be due to stress, because this group was down to 4 gorillas and 6 tourists visiting the group, because some of the gorillas had disappeared in the Democratic Republic of Congo across the border from Windi. And so when we got there, it really looked like scabies. There were 2 other vets who joined us, happened to be in American vets who Richard knew, Dr. Richard Koch knew, a vet from Kenya, and they joined us. And one of them had seen many, many cases of scabies in small animals in America, Dr. Mary Jane Goss, and her partner was the head of St. Louis Zoo. So he had a lot of experience with captive zoo animals. So we treated the gorillas, and the next day a few days later, the mother dropped the baby because the baby was too far gone. And when we did a postmortem, she was still crawling with mites in spite of, you know, the baby had died, but was still crawling with mites. The mites were alive. And then we started to ask ourselves, where did the scabies come from? And we looked around, and we finally concluded that they came from the local community, because people put out dirty clothing on scarecrows to chase away gorillas and other wildlife, like baboons. And gorillas are very curious. They would come close to you. I mean, people who visit them, you visited them, and you saw how they can actually get pretty close. You know, like they get curious, they can come near you. And they can also touch dirty clothing. And we think they touch the dirty clothing, and the mites spread through the group, because you can get scabies by wearing someone's sweater who has scabies. And so we realized that at that point, I realized you can't keep the gorillas healthy without improving the health of their human neighbors. And in my last year at the Wildlife Authority as their first vet, they asked me to lead an effort to start health education workshops to local communities. Being the only vet in the organization, they felt I was the best placed person to carry out those workshops. And that was a turning point in my life, because I didn't realize that people didn't have access to health services. A lot of them live 20 miles away from the nearest health center. And if they get very sick, they're carried on a stretcher to go to the health center. Otherwise, they just visit traditional healers and they rarely make it to the health center. And a lot of them had many preventable infectious diseases that the gorillas could pick up. And so when we met them, I told them what the problem was, how the gorillas got scabies. And I was about to tell them what the solution is. And I was together with the community conservation warden and ranger and the district health assistants who attend to their health. And the ranger touched my arm and said, wait, let's see what they have to say. And their suggestions and recommendations were way better than what I was going to propose for them. So that was a very humbling moment for me as a vet who's used to solving people's problems. And it was fascinating to hear what they had to say. I thought, even if they're poor and they're marginalized, they still know what's best for them, and they know how it works best in their situation. Participatory rural appraisal workshops is what the ranger told me it's called. And so a lot of what they suggested is what we used to start up the NGO Conservation Through Public Health a few years later.
How the communities have benefited enormously from gorilla tourism. How have you been able to show them that their lives will improve, that they will get clinics, they will get schools because of tourism? Was it very difficult in the beginning to talk to them and persuade them?
Well, when we had that workshop, I remember when they told us all the different reasons how they think we cannot make the gorillas sick. Like we met people in Uganda and DRC, because the gorillas at that time they were ranging a little bit in DRC. And some of the people in Uganda are much more trusting. And the question I always asked them was, how many of you here like gorillas? Almost everyone put up their hand in Uganda. And I said, why? And they said, because some of the money from tourism is shared with us. Our children are able to go to better schools. Some of our children have jobs, you know. But when I met with a certain farmer during those workshops, he said, we went and visited his farm when gorillas had just destroyed a banana plant. He said to me that my sons are employed by the Wildlife Authority, but the individual farmer like me, when my crops get destroyed, I'm not being compensated. So the human wildlife conflict was undermining the positive benefits that were coming from tourism. I talked to my bosses, and he became one of the leaders of the human gorilla conflict resolution team that had gorillas back. We now call them gorilla guardians. They had gorillas back to the park. But one of the things that we do as conservation through public health is, on top of promoting community-based healthcare together with conservation, because we work with community health workers who visit people's homes and carry out a lot of behavior change communication. And they talk about the importance of being healthy and hygienic, having hand washing stations, because improving community hygiene prevents infectious diseases like scabies, tuberculosis, and even COVID. Like, so, you know, hand washing prevents COVID.
This was a real example of how if we as humans can live in harmony with our neighbors, our wildlife neighbors, be they gorillas, be they beetles, whatever, it's essential, isn't it, Dr. Gladys?
Yes, it really is essential that communities have to have good health and well-being if the wildlife is going to survive. It really, really is essential. And for the great apes, it's even more critical because we share over 98% genetic material and can make each other sick. And so the fact that they were benefiting from tourism, it was giving jobs and everything, was helping. But improving community health also, we found that made them feel that you're not only concerned about the gorillas and the forest, but you're also caring about them because healthcare is a basic human right. Then it makes them want to support the conservation of the species, of the wildlife in the forest.
And just tell us about your coffee initiative. I just think that's so, so wonderful. You started an institution called G Coffee, Gorilla Coffee. Explain how that helps the communities, help the gorillas, helps everybody who wants to go and see the gorillas.
Yes, Gorilla Conservation Coffee is a social enterprise that we started. Conservation through public health is 20 years old this year, which is very exciting. And so the Gorilla Conservation Coffee began as a social enterprise in 2016. And we found out that many people are unhealthy because they're poor. And the coffee farmers who border the park, who often meet when you're going to visit the gorillas, were not getting a steady price or a fair price for their coffee. And they were still entering the forest to poach and collect firewood. Because it was easier to just go and hunt an animal like a duiker or a bush pig, rather than sell their coffee to buy meat. And so we started to work with them. And actually tourists often, when they're going to the gorillas, they stop and show them what the coffee tree looks like. And so we started, and we found that they grow very good coffee because it's a high altitude and windy. The mountain gorillas live high up in the mountain. And one of the coffee samples that we took to California, and was reviewed by Coffee Review in California, was among the top 30 coffees in the world in 2018 that they reviewed at 92 points. We're very excited. So now what we're doing is getting all the farmers to grow, to be at the same standard because they're able to produce very good coffee. And we sell it at a higher price to the tourists who visit the gorillas and other animals at the airport. But during the pandemic, we started to grow the market overseas because no tourists were coming. And these farmers could easily go back into the forest to poach because poaching went up in general in the whole park and in other national parks, not only in Uganda, but the whole of Africa. So we got a market in the UK with Money Row beans. Our US market was revived in 2021, you know, when they allowed planes to go to US. And then also before the pandemic, Kariko Cafe was bringing the coffee into South Africa. Would love them or any other group to be able to now start bringing coffee again. We need to revive that market in South Africa again, but also in New Zealand. And so that has really helped. And a donation from every bag sold goes to support the efforts, the community health, gorilla health and conservation and education efforts of conservation through public health. So we're currently engaging 500 farmers. We started off with 75, but we're unable to buy all their coffee because we don't have enough. We're not selling enough coffee to be able to engage to buy all their coffee, but we're training them. And that's why we need to have those additional markets to grow in South Africa and other countries so that the farmers we're engaging
a final question. Are you optimistic about the future? This grand plan of yours, which is working so well in Uganda, communities working with wildlife, do you think this can be extrapolated throughout the world? Can more people follow your example and the example of Uganda?
Definitely. I really do feel that it's really time for a One Health approach to conservation. where we address the health of people, animals and the environment together. But also it's really important to improve community well-being. And that's all very much part of our One Health approach, including food security. And, you know, supporting farmers bordering protected areas. Tourism is one way to provide sustainable financing for conservation, but tourism can stop anytime if there are lockdowns or other reasons. So there always have to be other ways that we can support the communities all over. And we're finding that as people are getting less, people are getting healthier, gorillas are falling sick less often as we continue to monitor the health of the gorillas. And I feel that this One Health approach can work anywhere where there are poor communities, bordering protected areas, places of high biodiversity all over Africa and all over the world. And would love for this model to be adapted and spread all over Africa and all over the world.
You really are, Dr. Gladys. You are such an inspiration. Thank you for all the work you've done, the work you're doing, and love the book. Once again, it's called Walking with Gorillas. It has a foreword by Dr. Jane Goodall. I have interviewed Jane Goodall in the past a couple of times, Gladys.
Wow.
Amazing lady, like yourself. Walking with Gorillas, The Journey of an African Wildlife Vet by Dr. Gladys Kalema Zikusoka. And she is the founder of Conservation Through Public Health. Well, that's all for this week. I'll see you next Sunday. Take care. Lots of love, lots of life. Look after yourselves. And you know what I always say, look after others too.